Hello, everyone. Before we get started, Jack is not going to be joining us this week because he has just had a tiny, tiny baby.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Jack.
We wish him all the best for his new little family. And in his place, we have Alex, producer.
Hello.
Hello. So lovely to have you on.
Yeah, so I'll just be filling in for a few episodes here and there. But yeah. Jack will be back as soon as his baby has grown up enough to be left home alone. But in the meantime, should we get stuck in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, on with the show.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, in ancient Rome, it was a cure for a sore throat.
The Germans used to style their hair with it.
And polar explorers eat it by the slab.
It's butter! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, I'm a chef and food writer, and I'm joined today by QI Elves Manu and Alex.
Hello Rosie.
Hey Rosie.
Very excited to be sat with you both today to discuss a topic dear to all of our hearts. So I'm 7 months pregnant and my mum and I have called the baby in my tummy butter since about week 16 because I ate 4 family-sized Lurpak containers of butter in my first trimester.
Just like the polar explorers then.
Yeah, because I was literally just like, all I wanted was buttered toast and I... butter liberally because I'm not a psycho. Mm-hmm. So yeah, butter baby is in my tummy right now.
It's going to come out so slippery.
Be the easiest birth.
It's like a butter luge.
I was going to say on spreading butter, the Danish word tansmør is my favorite word.
Right.
It's the layer of butter on toast or bread. If you spread it thick enough, it leaves tooth marks in.
Yes.
Oh, that's good.
The right amount.
Yeah. Well, the polar explorers eat it by the slab because they just need so many calories.
Mm, yes.
It will probably actually make you really ill in most circumstances.
Yeah.
But they're just burning, like, I think it's 8,000 calories a day on average.
It's
pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I think my favorite word is butter shag. I love a good butter shag.
Oh,
don't you?
God.
What's a butter shag?
It's, well, I guess there's two types, but the type that I'm talking about is 18th century Cumberland dialect for a slice of bread and butter.
Oh.
So it's a sexy way to put it.
Yeah. Okay, so sorry, what's butter then? Talk me through it.
It's just shook up cow juice is what I realized.
Oh, God.
Looking at what it was, and I was like, that's all it is.
It is. It is shook up cow juice.
I read that it's a really easy thing to have accidentally made because you would have got nomadic herders traversing long distances.
Plains.
And then they will have filled up their animal skins with milk for drinking. And then the movement of the horses and camels or what have you would have shaken up the cream and turned it into... They would have got there and be like, what the fuck? It's butter. It's really weird. It's like going on a school trip and packing sandwiches. And then when you get off to the science museum, you suddenly got cake in your bag. Yeah. Like, it must have been such a weird thing to happen.
Also very brave to try it.
Yeah.
Like it does not, you know, when you see the process of making butter, like what you get, the way it separates out from the milk is not a sexy ingredient.
No, it's really not.
Especially not if you're using, you know, like ultra unpasteurized, unhomogenized dairy product.
It's really interesting that you bring up the kind of nomadic history of butter because like way, way, way back when we started eating dairy, like as a species in general, there's historians that think we might actually have been eating butter before we drank milk. On a larger scale, because we've been eating butter for at least 10,000 years, according to a butter historian, Elaine Korsrov.
Great job to have.
Oh my God. She wrote a book. It's called Butter, A Rich History.
Oh, very nice.
I know. Yeah. So nice.
Spread through the ages.
Oh, very good. she said, we've only been able to digest dairy properly in like Western parts of the world for about 5,000 years. And there's still loads of places across the world where people don't deal with lactose sugar very well. Butter, because it's had a lot of the lactose removed from it, is actually easier to digest.
Okay. It's more fat.
Yeah, it's more fat, less of the sugars. It also keeps really well. So before refrigeration, this would have been a much safer way to store your dairy than the milk. So
I guess milk you have to store in the cow. That was the ultimate long life milk.
Most.
But even eating butter wasn't worldwide. So the Greeks saw eating butter as a mark of being like not Greek, mm-hmm. because it was a right. weird thing that other cultures did, mm-hmm. like the Thracians, because the Greeks had olive oil, mm-hmm. and so that was their, you know, fatty spread lubricant of choice, mm-hmm. on food. And so, like, you've got writers like Herodotus who would describe Thracians and Scythians as like foreign or barbaric, and they were like, they're so weird, they eat their butter, mm-hmm. they don't spread it on their aching limbs, which is what the Greeks used it for.
They're idiots. Yeah, they used to call us butter eaters.
Yeah.
And apparently the people in Asia as well, because obviously they didn't eat dairy. Yeah, they used to call us butter stinkers.
Yeah.
Proudly a butter stinker.
At Thank least it wasn't God. Like butter munchers, which sounds.
Oh, God. But what's really, really cool is in Ireland, which is also famous for its butter production, mm-hmm. got really good grass, make really good milk. They also have something called bog butter.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It is. I don't ever want to try it, but it is fun. So there are people in Ireland who dig up loads of peat, which is really rich soil created by like decomposing organic matter in wetlands. So it's really, really nutritious. But quite often, peat diggers will dig up really big chunks of preserved butter. So in 2009, someone dug up a 77-pound, like 3,000-year-old chunk of bog butter.
So this is, sorry, butter that somebody 3,000 years ago buried in the... They made the butter and then buried it in the bog.
Yes, exactly.
What? Mm-hmm. What were they? Didn't they need it?
No, they did. They did need it, like very much so. So historians think this was a way of preserving the butter, because if you bury it in the bog, it's quite cool, which is good for preservation. Yeah. It's also a high acid environment, which is really good for stopping microbes doing their thing. Mm-hmm. As is a low oxygen environment.
Right.
So if you bury it in the peat, it can last for a really, really long time. So much so that the stuff that they've dug up is technically edible.
Technically, it's doing a lot of work in that sentence there, Manny.
So people, like archaeologists, are like, you could eat it if you wanted to. It wouldn't kill you, but they would not recommend it.
As we've discussed before, they famously love to eat the shit that they dig up.
You know what? This one, I probably wouldn't. In 2012, there were chefs at Nordic Food Lab in Denmark, a really, really cool organization. They made their own bog butter, but they only fermented theirs underground for about 3 months. And that, they were like, oh, it was a lot. Like, it was really gamey. It was funky, pungent, a bit salami-esque.
The one word I don't want associated with one of my favorite things in the world is gamey.
Yeah.
Gamey puts me right off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what is really cool is, because back in the day in Ireland, butter was so valuable, you could pay taxes with butter.
Oh.
So they think one of the reasons why people might have been burying it, apart from to preserve it, is to protect it from thieves.
Oh, it's a
it
was tax like, dodge.
Oh, so, yeah. Exactly.
They're hiding their assets. It's like keeping stuff on the Cayman Islands.
Yeah.
But that's where all of Bezos's money is.
Oh, it's just wrapped up, all slimy. Did you know that butter caused the Reformation?
What?
So this is kind of true. It's just so bizarre. So during the late medieval period, the Catholic Church enforced some strict rules, as they love to do, on like fasting days. So in those days, that was like Wednesdays, Fridays, Saturdays, all of Lent, all of Advent. So like a lot of your life was taken up with fasting days. They banned not only meat, but also a lot of dairy products like butter and cheese. The idea behind it was that these were animal fats. They were rich, they're indulgent, they weren't sort of spiritual, minimalist.
Make you a bit horny, dairy, apparently.
Exactly. And the church don't like that. Butter was one that was banned. And obviously butter is crucial for so many things. There's an everyday fat for cooking, even just getting enough calories. It's not so bad in Italy, where they use olive oil a lot more. And that's where these rules were coming from the head of the Catholic Church in the Vatican. So it really created a lot of issues, especially for poor people. But the church had a system for getting around these rules, and they were called indulgences. And indulgences were basically, if you sin, there are a few things you can do. You can either confess and then you will be absolved by a member of the clergy, or you can be punished and get a punishment to pay for it, or you can get an indulgence, which is basically you pay the church for like an exemption on your sin. And so you could buy indulgences, you pay the church, and they effectively gave you like a butter license, a license to eat butter, mm-hmm. which is bonkers. But it was obviously a great money spinner for the church, and because it really favoured only people who could afford that, it created a ton of resentment, as you might imagine.
Yeah. Mm.
So Martin Luther, who was a 15th century German theologian, monk, and political activist and reformer, directly criticised the butter laws in particular, which he saw as like a symbol of this corruption in the church.
Elitism.
Exactly. Mm. And his campaign directly sparked the Protestant Reformation.
Right.
So thanks to butter bans, the Reformation came about.
Sometimes it is just the tasty things that will make people do crazy shit.
Yeah. 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 Don't take away the people's butter, I think.
Don't take it away.
Don't fuck with butter.
Is the moral of that story, yeah.
No.
Well, they had, so there's a section of the Rouen Cathedral that people call the Butter Tower.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or do you know about it?
I went there as a kid and assumed naturally that it was made of butter.
Yes.
I was very disappointed.
As you would. Yeah. I know, I'd be disappointed too. But that, they call it the Butter Tower because people were paying so much for these indulgences to eat butter that the Catholic Church obviously were just like, well, we'll build this section a little bit bigger then.
Honestly, classic. They had it coming with that Reformation shit. Mm.
Time now for our first lunchbox. And, well, I guess we're going to have to start talking about how butter's made, because I've made some. Like a tradwife wench pioneering woman that I am, from scratch.
Oh,
you've wrapped it up. It was almost like a sausage or something.
It does.
Like,
yeah. I've kept it nice and soft. Fabulous. For optimum spreading. And I bought some baguette.
Mm.
And because, guys, I was quoted this the other day, I didn't realise I'd said it. I'd said if I had to die with one taste in my mouth, it would be the taste of salted butter on French bread.
Oh my God. Look, I'm really behind you there. That is so...
That's a great taste, isn't it?
And great texture. So all I really know about butter making is churning with like a wooden thing and like moving a thing up and down suggestively to churn the butter.
So butter is made not from milk, but from cream. Cream is the thicker fat solids that rise to the top of milk. Back in the day, let's say pre-1900s, procuring fresh cream was quite a lengthy process because you had to wait for your milk to separate before you could get the cream. Then you could get the cream, then you can make the butter.
And now we speed it up by like using centrifuges and stuff, is that right?
Yeah, so actually Gustave de Laval manufactured the first hand-cranked centrifugal milk cream separator in the late 19th century. But before that, cooks were forced to wait up to a day for cream to naturally separate from the milk. Then it could be skimmed off. And then you do the next bit, which is what I'm going to tell you now. So basically, the science of butter making is pretty straightforward. Cream has a high percentage of butter fat in it. And as you whip and beat cream or agitate it in some way by churning it, riding a horse, those fat globules, the butter fat globules, they smash into each other and they eventually start to stick together and accumulate into larger and larger blobs of fat. The yellow butter fat becomes visible crumbles in a milky sea of white buttermilk.
It sounds very like cosmic. Mm. You know, the way the universe was formed with like all of this like dust and particles flowing around and they all get stuck together and turn into planets. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, I can tell you right now, it doesn't look like that. If you're going to make butter at home, it is probably for the best to buy higher quality cream. Unfortunately, like we were talking about food accessibility, you can make it with supermarket double cream for sure, but for the sort of tastiest butter to make at home, if you're insistent on making it at home, you should buy really, really nice cream. So I bought cream from Longley Farm Dairy, which are a great dairy.
Nice. I think also if you're making your own butter at this point, I feel like privilege is out the window.
Yeah, you don't really care about the cost.
You've got fucking time.
You're not going to the shop to buy it, so clearly something's wrong. So basically what I did was I put about 750 ml of cream in my mixer and I just let it whip. If you whip cream, you can get it to obviously perfect soft and stiff peaks. As soon as it starts to look granular, that's when you've over whipped it, but that's actually the first stages of butter. So you just keep it going, and then basically what happens is it suddenly just goes and all this water just drops out. You scoop out that solid yellow portion and you have to drain it and you have to wash it. So within the butter still, there's quite a lot of water. The reason why you have to get the water out is because it is what can cause microbial growth, i.e. bacteria, i.e. spoilage.
Mm.
So you fold it and you press it and then you wash it in cold, clean water, in icy cold, clean water. Rinse it a sort of a few times, knead it a bit, and then that's when you can add your salt right at the end. For this one, I salted it because I really like salted butter.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it takes. You can also add other flavorings too, but that would be known as a compound butter.
Mm.
For example, the most famous compound butter is garlic butter.
Pizza Express.
Yeah.
But the salt and butter is also helping with the preservation, isn't it?
Definitely. Yeah,
100%. Of course it is. That's so clever.
Yeah, no, it's cool.
Yeah. What I wanted to talk to you about as well was cooking with butter, what butters to use, what is spreadable butter, those kinds of things. I think it's probably everyone must know that spreadable butter is made by blending real butter with vegetable oils to make a softer, more spreadable consistency, even when it's at chilled, basically. Mm-hmm. Spreadable butter is really only good for spreading. Don't cook with it. It's not actually the best fat to use for cooking. I, for example, when I'm cooking with butter, will often add a drop of oil to the pan so that my butter doesn't burn. But I wouldn't use spreadable butter, which is just butter with oil in. But the reason why I do the oil my way is because I control how much there is. And I still get a better flavor because there's more milk solids in real butter than there are in spreadable butter.
And you're probably using better oil as well.
Better oil. And it's definitely, definitely not advised for baking because, again, because it has a lower fat content, lower milk solids. It's not got that great flavor.
Oh, yeah. Baking with vegan butter is, oh, it's a chore, man.
Yeah, savage. My next question. Which butter is best to cook with? A lot of the restaurants that I've ever worked in, maybe you'll find the same, we use French butter. French butters and British butters are different because the French have a much stronger tradition of culturing their butter. French butter is made with cultured cream, basically slightly fermented cream. What then gives it a really distinctive, slightly sour, richer, creamier taste. It's a little bit, have you ever noticed it tastes almost like creme fraiche? Like it's like really, that's because of the culturing, the fermentation. And then the only other thing I kind of wanted to talk about is temperature with butter, because when cooking with butter, temperature is really important.
And can we just take a second for like the point at which you put a small knob of butter into a pan? That's got to be aesthetically the best bit about all cooking.
Yeah, the swirl of that.
Yeah.
It's a gift.
And just when you watch it slowly melt.
Yeah. So butter is unlike most emulsions, which are oil in water. It is a water in oil emulsion. So it's majority fat, 80%, and the rest is water. So that means that it's hard in its at room temperature versus being soft. And for baking in particular, this is really, really important because there are functions with butter in baking that require it to be at different temperatures. You probably made a cake before. You've probably creamed butter and sugar together when it's soft. Basically, butter at that temperature, which is usually around 20 to 22 to 25 degrees, is pliable enough to trap air when you whip it. That trapped air, once then incorporated into a cake batter, for example, expands in the heat, creating light and fluffy and tender crumb. That's why you cream butter at room temperature. Cold butter is used specifically most often for like flakiness, flaky pastries, laminations. So your croissants, your viennoiseries.
We talked about this with Ed. Yeah.
You can go from frozen to up to, you know, 10 to 15 degrees with those ones. And basically what happens is the butter melts during baking and that creates steam. And that's what pushes the layers of whatever the structure is apart.
So that's why croissants are like, they're like filled with air pockets.
Yeah, exactly. Flaky crisp crust. And the same with like puff pastry, same with pie pastry. That's why a lot of recipes will be like, don't let your butter get too warm. And it's really important because you will suffer for it. Like it won't be as flaky, it won't be as crisp. So pay attention to that when you are baking. But anyway, I just thought that was all hopefully quite useful knowledge if you've ever wondered about butter and baking and why it's so important.
Yeah, it does so many different things.
It does a lot.
Thanks, butter.
Thanks, butter. Did you all like the homemade butter? Oh, I don't think I've made so enough. Good.
How long did it take you?
It took me about 10 minutes.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
If you have a stand mixer, it will take you literally 10 minutes to make.
Okay.
That's so cool. I read a recipe online, which was putting cream in a jar with a marble in it. And then you just shake that jar really vigorously. And that apparently churns butter as well.
Oh,
I'm sure it would.
That's like kind of on the go. Like, so you can do it on the way on the commute. Yeah. If you're too busy.
If you're ever going on a run.
If you want the trad wife and your job.
Go to the gym and you've got those shaky weights and you can just churn your butter.
Yeah, genuinely. Let's slide down the butter mountain into our second lunchbox. And that is you, Alex.
So this week I have brought some butter from the Channel Islands. Ooh. Have you ever been?
No, I haven't. I haven't had the luck.
No, neither have I. Whereabouts?
So they're quite quirky. They're a set of islands. They're in the English Channel, near to Normandy. Mm-hmm. They're technically called Crown Dependencies. So that means that they are in some way owned by the British Crown, but they are run independently. Mm. There's the biggest island is Jersey, and then the second biggest is Guernsey, and then there's Alderney and several other really small ones. Mm. Really lovely place to visit, especially this time of year. It's so nice. One of the things they're quite famous for is Guernsey and Jersey cows.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of
it. You will have heard of those. Mm. Also potatoes, Jersey potatoes. Mm-hmm. They're also very famous as well for the Jersey, i.e. the clothes.
Oh, yeah. Is that where Jersey...
Yeah, so as a little aside, the jersey is a type of sweater that has a specific pattern around the trim.
Right.
And there is also a Guernsey. So, yeah, they export clothes and they also export this very high quality and delicious dairy product. Mm-hmm. So milk and cream and butter. So the milk is really, really thick and the cream is just like super rich. You go to a Guernsey supermarket, like the M&S in Guernsey will have a very specific Guernsey milk and cream aisle, and it's really, really pretty.
Well, on restaurant menus, it will be Jersey or Guernsey cream. Like, you will specify.
Exactly. It's the high, they know really it's high the quality. Best. Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, I brought back on my way home some Guernsey butter.
Yeah. Do we need the baguette that I just cleared away?
I was gonna
I've also brought with me, and I meant to buy this from the Channel Islands, but I actually forgot on my way home. So I tried to make some Guernsey gosh. This is one of like Guernsey's most kind of beloved bakes. It's this sweet yeasted fruit bread. It's made with raisins and sultanas and sometimes glacier cherries. And it's very, very rich when it's served with butter. And it's like a staple tea time treat. Big part of the island's cultural identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the word gash actually comes, sorry, the word gosh, the word... I keep doing it because it's about the word gosh. It's spelled G-A-C-H-E with a little circumflex accent on the A. Mm. It's from Guernseyese, which is the island's Norman dialect. It simply means like cake. But it shares roots with the word gasto, which went to gâteau, which is French for cake. So you see where the connection is. Traditionally, you eat your Guernsey gosh with a generous dollop of Guernsey butter.
Oh, that smells lovely.
Should we have a
Yeah.
And so if I open it, the first thing you will notice.
Oh
yeah.
Whoa.
It is a very, very rich yellow.
I'm going for
that is a very generous
that's a
smear.
Good...
Yeah, but I'm pregnant.
Rosie has put butter that is now thicker than the gosh.
What's the word?
Tansmore.
I wanted to Tansmore my bread.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Very good.
You've done well.
All right, bottoms up.
Oh, incredibly rich.
But really good. The butter is sensational.
The butter is so good, isn't it? Wow. The butter is very, very yellow. And the reason for that is that it's got a lot of beta carotene in it.
Mm.
Beta carotene is what makes grass green, okay? It's a pigment.
Yeah.
And usually cows digest it out, basically, and break it down. But Guernsey and Jersey cows aren't very good at that. So more of it ends up in the milk and the cheese, which is gives it this bright yellow glow.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So... when you look at regular bog standards, not bog standards, it's not from the bog, but maybe that's where bog standard comes from. The regular supermarket butter we have here, which is whatever this was, I think M&S own brand. So a lot of the butter that you eat at home is not naturally that yellow.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It is often the manufacturers will add colorants like annetto, which comes from seeds, or they'll even add beta carotene. So they're natural colorants and dyes, but they are artificially making the butter more yellow. And that's because consumers like it. Mm-hmm. We don't like pale, anemic butter. We like rich yellow butter. We really associate that with being good butter.
It would be a red flag for me if I opened a British butter pat and it was like bright white. I'd be like, what the hell's that?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's true.
Beta carotene is also what they put in... feed chickens to make their egg yolks yellower.
There you go. Exactly. Like, we love this rich yellow colouring in our food. Mm-hmm. And also, I think the type of grass that cows are eating, the type of cows that you have, the time of year, and like where the grass is in its annual cycle, all of these things affect how yellow like mm-hmm. the butter is, what consistency the cream is. And so there has to be all of this homogenization throughout the year. Mm. So much work is basically done to give us an identical block mm-hmm. of perfectly yellowed, perfectly consisted butter mm. all year round. And we never think about it. Like, yeah. you know, it comes from a really natural place and cows have good days and bad days. And,
yeah, so and, what know. Was that you were saying about you loving ultra processed food and like, you know.
I do love it. I absolutely love it. I really appreciate all the work that goes into me not having to be like, oh, milk's a bit white today. Like, it's yeah. that's great. But it's awesome that the Guernsey, the Jersey butter is natural and it's that yellow naturally. It's just down to the cows being quite bad at digesting beta carotene.
But I love the fact that in the winter, your butter's naturally going to be a bit paler because the cows can't eat grass because it's cold and everything's frozen. So they go inside, they start eating hay or corn. So a lot of like not grass-fed butter is paler because they're eating corn, which is also why they'll diet. So it's your grass-fed is going to be darker than your other ones. But they've been dyeing butter for like centuries. So they used to use carrot, like straight up grated carrots, and boil that in the cream. And that would be used to dye it a little bit orange, but also the flavor of the carrots would come through, so it wasn't very popular.
Yeah, shocking that.
But also marigolds as well. They used to use marigolds to dye butter back in the day.
Oh. Really? Have you done the buttercup test?
Oh my god, if you sell this as a true fact, Rosie.
It's sort of.
Guys, the only way to tell if someone likes butter or not is to hold a buttercup under their chin. And if their chin is yellow, you know they love butter.
Yeah. I've never met anyone who doesn't like butter, is my problem.
Yeah. But it's really cool because the petals in buttercup flowers have like a special property which makes them reflect more of that yellow light than say other yellow flowers do. That's why you can do that experiment because of the structure of the petals.
Let's not call it an experiment.
Sorry. They're science
deeply
behind.
Schoolyard
prank.
But buttercups are a very cool plant.
So color as you say has for a really long time played a big part in the butter industry. Most notably when margarine came about as an alternative. I didn't know. Invented by Napoleon. Napoleon III, well, not invented personally, but he offered a big prize in like the mid-19th century to anyone that could develop a cheap butter alternative because he needed to feed all the French workers and his big armies in the Franco-Prussian War. So this like big competition that he set up led to a French chemist called, okay, I'm going to have a go at this, Hippolyte Meige-Maurier.
Oh, that sounded good. Yeah, lovely.
Hippolyte Meige-Maurier.
This is why the French are sexier than
He developed and patented margarine in 1869.
Right.
And it was originally called oleomargarine. The margarine bit refers to margaric acid, which is the fatty bit, the kind of pearly white sheen that it like leaves when it's crystallized. And margarine means pearl, basically. And the name Margaret comes from the same word as well.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. And it entered the US in the 1870s as a great kind of inexpensive substitute for butter. But understandably faced a lot of opposition from the dairy industry because it was undercutting them. And they lobbied the government very heavily to try and put a stop to this. And they were very successful. The 1886 Margarine Act put like a lot of really steep taxes on it. And you had to have like licenses that they imposed. You had to pay lots of really heavy fees for those. Several states outright banned margarine just on the grounds that it was like a threat to family farms and moral order as well. Again, don't mess with people's butter. No, like people do not like it. So then there followed what is known as the Butter Wars, which was this very dramatic series of political and legal battles that played out between the dairy industry and margarine manufacturers. It was across the kind of a whole 19th and 20th century. But interestingly, margarine was naturally sort of white, as we said, and it's not very appealing to customers, so manufacturers would tint it yellow. And in response, 32 states passed laws preventing manufacturers from dyeing margarine yellow, and some even made them dye them off-putting colours like pink or black or grey. Just to make it look as unappealing as possible. A lot of these laws did not last very long because it's obviously so unfair. Like, it just makes them completely unbuyable. But then margarine producers tried to get around that by selling plain margarine that was white along with a dye kit so that you could take it home and dye your margarine yellow.
Oh, you know what? I've seen adverts for that like squeezy 90s spreadable butter that's like pink and blue.
Really?
Yeah, it looks terrible.
Yeah, I think they re-released some actually like in 2002.
Serious?
Yeah, there's a company called Parquet in America, I think, and they produce squeezy margarine, which already is like so American. Mm-hmm. But they released a pink one as like a throwback to like, you know, like honoring our heritage.
would you eat it, you guys?
I mean, no. Like, no. Not. I take myself seriously. Our third and final lunchbox is from my sweet Manu today. I'm trepidatious, shall I say.
I am also quite scared of this one. So, today I have brought a version of Tibetan butter tea.
Ooh.
Or pocha. It's a tea that they brew, which has got lots of yak butter in it. So a female yak is called a nak. So it's nak butter tea.
So first of all, we've got some tea brewing. Is that a regular tea bag in there?
That is just regular black tea.
Okay, right. Then we've got this very suspicious looking box of white powder.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that is oats that I've blitzed up. Traditionally,
officer.
Yeah, I promise. So they'd use barley flour, roasted barley flour, but mm-hmm. I didn't have any of that, so I just blended some oats.
Okay.
And we also have goat's butter because I wanted something that was a little bit more funky, a little bit more gamey than cow's butter.
Don't use the word gamey. We talked about this.
It definitely smells goatier.
But yeah, this was actually something my friends who are traveling around Mongolia also tried, like the tea with butter in it.
You've put a sort of a teaspoonful of oats in mm-hmm. the mug and also about a knob of the goat's butter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we're just going to pour the brewed tea on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also a decent amount of salt in our mugs as well. Because
okay, right.
Oh, they drink it salty.
I've got to say, it's not super appealing at the moment, but
I don't think it's
deconstructed, Rosie. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, it feels quite medicinal.
Well, that's the thing. So it's high salt, which is great for energy boosts as well. It also kind of counteracts the diuretic effects of tea, which makes you pee a lot and lose salt.
Right.
And the fat in the butter is really good for like going around high altitude, mountaineering.
I was going to say this does feel sort of like necessary for people who do like extremely high exertion sort of like walks and stuff.
Yeah, and it's cold,
in the Himalayas.
Yeah.
And the butter, I guess, is kind of, you don't need to put milk in to kind of thicken up the brew.
Yeah.
Which means that this would also travel way better, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the polar explorers you were talking about eating slabs of butter. Yeah. But apparently it's not actually that common. Like most families drink a version with Nak's milk, not Nak's butter, because Nak's butter is quite expensive. So we're getting like the fancy version of this. But yeah, it's really good at high altitude. So in the Juying Heju Valley is about 5,000 meters elevation.
Oh my God.
For context, we are at about 11 meters of elevation.
I bet it's popular as fucking Hackney Wakeboat. This is exactly the kind of stuff they mess around with.
Yeah, for sure. Well, do we want to try a little bit?
Yeah.
There's been a trend in the last couple of years. I think it's sort of dying off now, but there was this thing called bulletproof coffee, which is what people were doing to coffee like in the last couple of years. So they've been adding knobs of butter, right?
That's exactly right. The guy who introduced bullet coffee to the Western world, his name's Dave Asprey, and he was inspired by Tibetan.
Oh,
so he was big into what he called like his bulletproof diet, which was like super, super high fat, pretty high protein, kind of similar to keto. So yeah, he was like, oh, this is obviously really good for you. And it's a pseudoscientific diet. Like, if you're not crazy high up and doing loads of mad sports, you do not need this many calories in your tea.
Okay,
should we give it a go?
Yeah.
It's chunky.
Yeah, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of problems for me. The fact that the butter obviously doesn't emulsify and also the chunky oat.
I'm not a fan of that texture. I'm really sorry.
So yeah, it's really funny as well watching kind of travel YouTubers try the butter tea, because I think yak's butter is even more gamey than goat's butter.
I bet.
Normally people are really complimentary when they're trying like different people's foods and stuff, but whenever you watch them try this, they're like, oh, it's powerful stuff. Yes. But yeah, it's not my favorite, but they do have other really cool traditions with butter in Tibet, and one of them is butter carving.
Okay.
Oh yeah, that's amazing. I've seen some of this.
It's so beautiful. If you haven't seen it, do look it up. So it's a kind of art they practiced in a lot of Buddhist temples. They make incredibly elaborate sculptures. A lot of them are like mandalas or kind of, is it diorama? What's the word for like a scene of nature?
I think it's diorama.
Yeah, like the nativity.
Yeah, but not Jesus.
Yeah, they're not that big of a...
Famously, diorama, isn't it?
So they'll make these incredible sculptures out of butter and flour. Again, the barley flour. So there are a few different ways to make it, but the one that I've seen the most of is you make a kind of water and barley flour paste, and then you make the base of the sculpture with that paste, and then you paint it in melted butter and you let it dry, and that forms like a pretty solid foundation for making incredibly detailed, like, buttery.
Yeah, I can imagine butter would be quite good material for that.
Yeah, I guess also there's the handy thing is that the sort of temperature there is low enough that butter is nice and solid.
But what's really cool is the part of the reason for these sculptures is their impermanence. Obviously in Buddhism you have a whole thing about like the impermanence of things, so spending loads of time making these incredibly beautiful sculptures which will just melt and deteriorate really quickly when they're they're also painted really beautifully as well, so it's it's super cool. Like
with edible paint, they're not supposed to be edible, right?
That's I assumed that they weren't for eating, and many of them aren't, but there are some that are made for eating, which is so cool.
That's good.
Apparently, butter molding is also popping off in a big way in Western kitchens today. So, like, butter molding was really popular in the early 20th century, especially after the advent of refrigeration. So, you had like really lavish dinners with all of these incredible butter sculptures. But now it's like, really popular in London.
On Instagram now, it's popped off.
Everyone's, really?
Yeah, because I guess there's a little bit of a return to retro and sort of like vintage vibes, and you know,
I was going to say butter boards are a thing as well, aren't they?
Butter boards,
Instead is that like waterboarding but with butter?
I'll tell you anything. Just
lock me up.
A butter board was basically like another Instagram or sort of social media trend where basically you put sometimes compound butters, so flavored butters, sometimes just a regular butter. Like spread it in a sort of very aesthetically pleasing way across a board, and then you would sort of garnish it almost with all the things that you would want to have with your butter. Let's say sea salt, radish, like frying herbs, like, you know, whatever.
Oh, I see. So the butter is the base.
When I was reading about butter sculpting today in British Vogue, they said butter sculptures and molds have been trending because food art has temporal value. They basically, you have to be there with your body in the room at the time because it doesn't last.
It's an experience. You can't,
I actually spoke about this for Service 95, which is Dua Lipa's newsletter. There's been a real trend towards elaborate food art as kind of immersive event hosting. Yeah. For example, one of the sort of industries that seems to be doing it a lot, which is a little bit ironic, is the fashion industry, because brands will be like, okay, we want you to make us this amazing grazing table, but like, you know, when you see pictures of it, there's like three boiled eggs in a row on a beautiful silver tray. And they always look very beautiful. Like, the word I think is aspirational. But actually, practically, functionally, they don't feed people. As soon as one person takes one thing, they look shit.
Yeah.
And
so it's perfect for fashion.
It's kind of like the opposite of putting bread and butter on the table and being like, help yourselves. They're like the antithesis of what food should be about. That's what I said anyway.
This is how revolutions start, as we have learned. You start messing around with food, making it too fancy.
Yeah.
The moral of the story today is don't fuck with butter.
Yeah, do not.
Yeah.
Also, Dua Lipa, if she's going to have like a newsletter on like fats and butter, she should call it Lipa's Lipids.
That is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox MB. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox MB Pod.
That is right. And you can also get in touch and send us your facts, your recipes, and your questions. Please send us your questions. We'd love to hear them by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any butter-based recipes for us this week?
Well, actually, yes. In my cookbook, Good Time Cooking, I have a recipe for ham butter as a cheat way to make rillettes, which is similar to a pâté, but takes a long time to make. Actually, if you just put some ham hock through some butter, you got something pretty similar. And it's very delicious with bread and pickles. Ooh. So yeah, do take a look.
That sounds delicious.
And we will leave you with this quote from one of my favourite films.
I thought it might be.
Julie and Julia. Every time you taste something that's delicious beyond imagining and you say, what's in this? The answer is always going to be butter. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Alex Bell, Manu Onrio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.